February 22nd, 2023, in Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 10, Text 25.
Material transformation.
Vishvasturit. Of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is a friend to everyone. Sakasya. Of you, the friend. Samyena. Because of your mental equilibrium. Vita abhimate. Who have completely forsaken the bodily concept of life. Tava. Your. Api. Indeed. Mahat vimanat. Of insulting a great devotee. Swakritat. From my own activity.
Certainly.
Madrik.
A person like me.
Nankshyati.
Will be destroyed.
Adurat. Very soon. Api. Certainly. Shulapanihi. Even though as powerful as Lord Shiva, Shulapani. Srila Prabhupada's translation, O my dear Lord, you are the friend of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is Rahugana talking to Jud Bharat, who is the friend of all living entities. You are therefore equal to everyone, and you are free from the bodily conception. Although I have committed an offense by insulting you, I know that there is no loss or gain due to my insult. You are fixed in your determination, but I have committed an offense. Because of this, even though I may be as strong as Lord Shiva, I shall be vanquished without delay due to my offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Maharaj Rahugana was very intelligent and conscious of the inauspicious effects arising from insulting a Vaishnava. He was therefore very anxious to be excused by Jadabharata. Following in the footsteps of Maharaj Rahugana, everyone should be very cautious not to commit an offense at the lotus feet of Vaishnava. Srila Vrindavan Das Thakur in the Chaitanya Bhagavata, Madhya Khanda 13.388.390 says, Shulapani, it's the same word, Shulapani, as we have in today's verse, Shulapani sama yadi bhakta ninda kare bhagavata pramana tatapi sigra mare hena vaishnavera ninde sarvagna hayi Se janera adha pata sarva shastra kai. Even if one is strong as Lord Shiva, who carries a trident in his hand, one will nonetheless fall down from his spiritual position if he tries to insult a Vaishnava. That is the verdict of all Vedic scriptures. He also says this in Chaitanya Bhagavata, Madhya Khanda 22.129 and 22.55-56. Vaishnavera ninda kari beka yara gana tara raksha samartya nahika kona jana shulapani, again we have this word shulapani sama yadi vaishnavera ninde tata pila nasa yaya kaha shastra vrinde iha na maniya ye sujana ninda kare janme janme se papishta daiva dosha mare. One who blasphemes a Vaishnava cannot be protected by anyone. Even if a person is as strong as Lord Shiva, if he blasphemes a Vaishnava, he is sure to be destroyed. This is the verdict of all Shastras. If one does not care for the verdict of the Shastras and dares blaspheme a Vaishnava, he suffers life after life because of this. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the fifth canto, 10th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Discussion Between Jadbharata and Maharaj Rahugana. Na vikriya vishvasurita kasya samyena vita bhima testavapi mahadvimana swakrita dimadrin nakshyatya duran apisulapani. Again, this is Rahugana speaking to Jadbharata. O my dear Lord, you are the friend of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the friend of all living entities. You are therefore equal to everyone, and you are free from the bodily conception. Although I have committed an offense by insulting you, I know that there is no loss or gain for you due to my insult. You are fixed in your determination, but I have committed an offense. Because of this, even though I may be as strong as Lord Shiva, I shall be vanquished without delay due to my offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava. So, what we'd like to try to accomplish in this class is to become inoffensive, to not offend others, and to be unoffendable, to not take offense. Because these two are very related. They're very related. Why did Maharaj Rahugana insult Jadbharata? Because he thought Jadbharata had offended him. He thought by Jadbharata carrying the palanquin shakily that he was insulted. He didn't know, he didn't think about, didn't consider that Jadbharata was carrying the palanquin shakily because he didn't want to step on the bugs. He thought, this guy doesn't respect me. He doesn't respect that I'm the king. And so he's intentionally shaking me around as a way of showing disrespect. That was the story he had in his head. And because he was offended, therefore he insulted King Rahugana. Here is saying, as strong as Lord Shiva, the carrier of the trident, Shulapanihi. So we have a personality, Durvasa Muni, who is a partial incarnation of Lord Shiva. One can say he's as strong as Lord Shiva. And we have a very similar situation, that Durvasa Muni comes to visit King Ambarish. It's the Dwadasi day. He comes just when the king needs to break his fast. But Durvasa has gone to take a bath. After you've done a lot of travel, one is supposed to bathe in order to resettle the subtle body. So he's going to take a bath and then he's going to eat. The problem was he was so long taking a bath that the breakfast time was going to pass. And King Ambarish wanted to observe the ritual properly. So he consulted with brahmanas and he decided, since he had been doing a nirjal, he'd been fasting for food and water, that if he just drank some water he would be breaking his fast, but he wouldn't be eating before his guest. So he did that. When Durvasa Muni returned, because he was as strong as Lord Shiva, as powerful as Lord Shiva, he could understand without anybody telling him, "Oh, Maharaj Ambarish has had some water while I was taking a bath." I mean, this is kind of inconceivable to us, I think, in the world in 2023, that a guest comes and they're going to take a shower, and so you have some water to drink while they're in the shower, and you wouldn't think twice about it. But Durvasa was so angry because he felt he had been insulted. He thought, Ambarish is showing disrespect to me. He thinks he's better than me. He thinks he doesn't have to treat me properly. And he was so angry that he tried to kill Maharaj Ambarish. And he created this demon from his mystic power and tried to kill him. So this is Indra. Of course, Indra was doing this not exactly just with Vaishnavas, but with God also. So, you know, there's this regular yajna for Indra. And Krishna wanted to show that the demigod shouldn't be worshipped independently of him. And so he asked his father, please, instead of worshipping Indra, can we worship Govardhan? And Indra decided that he had been insulted. You know, he decided he was insulted. And because he was insulted, he tried to kill everyone. I mean, that's the worst kind of offense, is a physical offense. I mean, even legally and practically, the worst abuse. You know, if you say someone's abusive, but they're just verbally abusive, people may think, well, maybe they really weren't. But a physical abuse is incontrovertible. You know, you have a bruise or a broken bone or something. And so physical is an extreme form of abuse. Then the lesser is verbal, and lesser than that is mental. So we see that people tend to offend when they feel offended. In fact, very few people will offend if they don't feel offended. That's extremely rare. I mean, it happens. Like we say that a snake is like that. We say that a snake, if you just walk past a snake and the snake feels the vibration on the ground, it will assume that you're an enemy, even if you've done nothing at all to bother it, and it will bite you, even though you're just leaving it alone and walking down the street, right? Or they have, we have in North America, poison ivy, poison oak, poison sumac. And again, if you're just minding your own business and you just brush up against it, you're not trying to pick it, you're not trying to kill it, you're not trying to hurt it. The oils on the plant will give you a terrible itchy rash that lasts for weeks, and you can't sleep, and it's horrific. So there are certainly beings who offend without being offended. And we sometimes find this also among humans, that there are humans where, and this behavior, by the way, is the hallmark of an abusive person, that an abusive person is not lashing out of anger from being offended. They just lash out, or they imagine that they're offended by anything. You know, just that your breathing offends them or something like that. People who are extremely easily offended. So that therefore we want to look at this point today. If we really want to not offend others, we also have to learn how to not feel offended by others. All right, so we're going to look at what is the harm of offending particularly Vaishnavas, and who are Vaishnavas. All right, and then how do we give up offending them, which we've talked about a little bit so far, we've hinted at, and then what's the result if we stop being offended and stop offending? So what's the harm? So the Vaishnavas particularly, they're our gateway to spiritual knowledge and liberation and love of God. Without the Vaishnavas, we really can't access anything beyond this world. They're the emissaries of another world. It's like, you know, if I want to go to another country, I have to get on an airplane or a boat or something to get there. I need some kind of means. I mean, if it's a country very close by, I suppose I need a road or something. But, you know, I need some kind of way of accessing it. And I can't access the higher realms, even though we are spiritual beings and spiritual knowledge is our original position. We cannot access it without somebody giving us access. And Krishna is neutral. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that the Lord's mercy follows the mercy of the devotees. And so it's by the mercy of those who are living in that realm and have access to that realm that we can get access. So if we want liberation, if we want enlightenment, if we want freedom from material miseries, if we want spiritual happiness, if we want love of God, we are dependent on those who have it. And if we offend them, they're not going to be particularly interested in sharing that with us. And that's, why should they be? I mean, on a very practical level, why would I help somebody who's disrespectful to me? I mean, who's going to do that? It's actually an offense on my part if I do that. One of the offenses is to preach the glories to the faithless. Jesus says, don't throw your pearls before swine. They'll just trample it. You know, it's actually offensive on my part to give spiritual knowledge, to give spiritual awareness to somebody who's very disrespectful to me. They'll misuse it. So it's not just an ego thing that the devotee's offended and therefore they're not going to grant you mercy. But it's that they, what they have is very precious. And they want to give, I mean, love is a very precious thing. Freedom is a very precious thing. And they want to give that to those who are going to treat it with regard. If you don't treat the messenger with regard, you know, how are you going to, just like Hanuman was very much offended by Ravana. Why? Because Ravana didn't respect Ram. showing disrespect to the messenger was a way of showing disrespect to the master. Yes, so why should anyone give love for Krishna to someone who has no respect for Krishna? So we will lose our access. And what happens is if people try to take up a spiritual process while offending the Vaishnavas, is they can never really access it. They may be able intellectually to explain the philosophy. They may, because of determination or whatever, be able to practice the external mechanical behaviors of that process, but they won't actually access the result of that process. And we see that practically. We see people who are, I mean, I'm sure we all know of people who eat Vaishnava Parad for dessert every day. I know some people like this, and they may be very strict in chanting their rounds and following the principles and et cetera, et cetera, but they're not achieving an inner state of Krishna consciousness. And what's interesting is that such a thing tends to be self-perpetuating, so they don't achieve inner Krishna consciousness, and so they become angry and frustrated, and they think, well, it can't be me, you know, I'm following the process, and it can't be the process is good, so it must be the devotees, they must be the problem. And so they get more angry at the devotees, which cuts them off even more from actually tasting the fruit of the process. So they're, just like Śrīla Bhakti Śrīmad-Bhāgavatam said, licking the outside of the jar of honey. You know, that's all. And Krishna's not happy. I mean, any of us who have children, we know that we're much more offended if somebody hurts our children than if they hurt us. I mean, this is just practical experience. Or people who have pets. You know, if you have some living being that's under your shelter, that's dependent on you, that you're taking care of with great affection, and somebody harms that living being, you're going to rise to protect them. Of course it's like that. We're all like that. Whether that living being is our child or our grandchild or our student or our dog or whatever. Plants that we're taking care of. So Krishna feels like that. He feels like these are the people who are directly under my shelter. These are the people who directly love me. And how can you hurt them? Krishna will tolerate offenses against himself much more than offenses against the devotees. And again, we're all like that. So because one might make the argument, well, I don't need the devotees to access enlightenment and love of God because it's inherent in me and God is everywhere. I'll just directly access it through God. Now, maybe there are no devotees in your area and you've never met a devotee, that may be effective. But if you've actually offended the devotees, you're not going to be able to access love of God through the devotees, and Krishna is not going to let you access it through him directly because he's angry with you. He doesn't want anything to do with you. So it basically cuts us off from spiritual life. And it's a self-perpetuating circle. And maybe you can all think of people like this. I can think of several people like this where, you know, they're regularly offending devotees. And they are strict externally, but they're always angry and frustrated and disturbed. And that makes them more angry at the devotees and so forth. So what do we mean by devotees? And I think that this question is huge, because the people who regularly offend devotees, who make that as their habit and their delight in life, they're reasoning that I've come across is always, well, this person isn't really a devotee. They're a pretender. They're a materialist. Devotees are actually, you know, very high. Now, Srila Prabhupada doesn't accept this kind of reasoning. There's a letter with regard to Siddha Sarupa about this, and Prabhupada said, why are you only saying Siddha Sarupa is a pure devotee? All my disciples are pure devotees. So there's different levels of devotees, and these are explained differently in different places. There's beginners, intermediate, and advanced devotees. And a beginner devotee is defined in some places as just someone who chants the holy name of the Lord. Who's once chanted the holy name. Prabhupada talks about George Harrison as being in this category. And we could certainly look at, and Prabhupada, when talking about not blaspheming devotees as the first offense in chanting Hare Krishna, he talks about Jesus and Muhammad. So basically, anybody who is believing in God and praying to God, even if they're at a very, very low level of realization, even if they think that God is just their own understanding of God in their temple, in their church, and other believers are heretics, they're still a devotee. Now, there is a problem with understanding who is and who is not a devotee because of 930, the Apichet Sutaracharya verse, because we know that devotees are generally described as having good qualities. Devotees are described, it's one of the ways you tell who's a devotee, that they have good qualities. But sometimes a devotee may exhibit some qualities that are not so nice due to their past habits or due to some social, they're violating some sort of social norm, not a moral norm, but a social norm. The example I always give that when those of us who joined ISKCON in the 60s and 70s, we violated Vedic social norms, most of us. I mean, I did, because my mother actively forbade me from joining the Hare Krishna movement. My father was very enthusiastic, but my mother actively forbade me, and I joined over her opposition. So that is a violation of a Vedic norm, that I went against the order of my mother. We think about the Pandavas when their mother said, share your alms. Then even though she hadn't intended that to apply to a woman, they took it as an order from her mother, that's it. You know, my mother's like, no, don't join the Hare Krishna movement. I'm like, sorry, I'm going to do it anyway. So that's an example of something talked about in 930. Anyway, so a devotee may do something wrong from many different points of view, but they're still a devotee. So how do you tell if a person is just a degenerate criminal who's making a show of being a devotee for the purpose of cheating people, or if they're a real devotee who's just having some kind of weakness or some kind of problem that they're dealing with? How do you tell if they're wicked or weak? From the beginning of time, there are demons who dress themselves as devotees. Ravana dressed himself as a holy man. So many of the demons in Krishna Lila, Pralambasura, Vyomasura, they appeared to be Krishna's friends. They appeared to be devotees. You have Putana, of course, Ram's pastime, Shopanika. They appear to be something that they're not, but actually they're demons. And there's one purport where Prabhupada says there's many demons in the dress of devotees. You know, out in the world, there are criminals who dress as police officers. You know, I mean, it's, then you have an in. So how do you know? So my sad answer to this, perhaps, is that you can't absolutely know. We cannot absolutely know. We cannot look at someone and say, well, they've done this heinous stuff, so they're not a devotee. Or, you know, they have good character, so they are a devotee. Or they're dressed like a devotee. Or they chant Hare Krishna, they must be a devotee. You know, it's, I give the example often about Ram Das Vilas, how he was traveling with Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, and he was carrying Raghunath Bhatta Goswami's bags, and he was chanting Ram, 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 Ram constantly. But he was an impersonalist. He wasn't a devotee. I mean, he was a transcendentalist, definitely, but he wasn't a devotee. He wasn't a Vaishnava. And when they came to Jagannath Puri, Lord Chaitanya paid him no attention at all. Now, one would, you know, I would look at him and think, well, he's a devotee. He's serving Raghunath Bhatta Goswami and he's constantly chanting the holy name. He must be a devotee, but he wasn't. And on the other hand, we have someone like Vamsi Das Babaji, who was yelling at his deities and he wasn't taking a bath. And we might say, well, he's just offensive. What kind of a person is that? He's not a devotee. So the safe side is to say Jivaraswar Paya Krishnara Nityadasa, everybody is on some level in some way a devotee. And therefore we should not offend anyone. We should not offend anyone. And particularly we should not offend people who are at least externally worshiping the Lord. So if anybody on the external level is worshiping the Lord, but we shouldn't offend anyone. I mean, here King Rahukana, he had no way of telling that Jad Bharata was a great Vaishnava and a liberated soul. He had no way at all. The man looked like he was deaf, dumb, and blind, and he was dirty and uncared for. He looked like some, you know, homeless bum in the street. And he had no idea he was dealing with a saintly person until Judd Barrett opened his mouth and started preaching. So better not to offend anyone. All right, so then what are we going to do? What's the how? Well, this first point is a little tricky. And I find that it's very, very difficult for people to be able to even understand this concept, what to speak of, do it. But once you get the concept and you practice doing it, then you never want to go back. And that is sticking to facts instead of our interpretation of the facts. Now, I say this is very hard to do because most of us are so accustomed to immediately and unconsciously interpreting facts and then accepting our interpretation as the facts, that we really believe that our interpretation of facts and facts are exactly the same thing. Well, that's what happened. Now, the fact was that Maharaj Ambarish drank some water while Durvasa was bathing. That's a fact. A fact can be seen with a camera, heard with a microphone. That's a fact. Maharaj Ambarish offended me. He disrespected me. That's an interpretation of the fact. Judd Bharata was moving the palanquin shakily. He wasn't walking in a straight line. He was walking crookedly. That's a fact. Why he did that is an interpretation. He did that to disrespect me. That's an interpretation. That's a story. To stick to observable facts. Again, this is, I have taught this to many people and found that most people cannot even tell the difference. And we're attached to our story because our story justifies our being offended and offending others. Well, I can be rude and nasty and insulting and critical of this person because of this and this and this and this and this. Now, sometimes facts are very accused. They're nasty. And sometimes a person really did rape a child or really did steal money or really did, you know, murder their spouse. Sometimes the facts in and of themselves are condemning. No? And that's fine. If we know that somebody, you know, raped their daughter or shot their husband or stole money from a bank, that is not fault-finding. Prabhupada said to call a thief is not fault-finding. It's just a fact. Now, if there's no benefit to telling that to others, there's no reason why we should. I don't have to go to people and tell them about all the crimes that everybody has committed in the world. First of all, I would never even get any sleep. And second of all, it wouldn't be of any benefit to anybody. But there's going to be situations in which there's benefit for people to know. Hey, I don't think you should let this person stay at the ashram because they shot their wife. I don't think you should let this person stay at the temple because they raped their daughter. I mean, that's just a fact. No judgment. Therefore, they're an evil person. Therefore, they're not a devotee. Therefore, they're this or that. There's no need for having some interpretation. That's Krishna's business. It's actually not ours. So we just stick to facts. And for minor things, I mean, major thing, you know, you shoot your husband in the head and kill him. There's not really discussion about that. You call the police and the person goes to jail and so forth. If it's going to be minor things, like, oh, yesterday you said that you'd meet me at 5 o'clock and today you never showed up, then we ask the other person, what's their side of the story? And we try to connect with people, and we try to be kind to people, and we realize, and we remind ourselves, that we do things all the time that other people find painful. We are misunderstood, we are misinterpreted, and sometimes we actually are nasty. Sometimes our motives are nasty. So we decide, we make a determination that whatever somebody does, we are not going to be offended by it. Now, how do we make that determination? Because what other people do is always about them. It's always about their needs and their feelings and their desires. It's never really about us, even if they actively hate us and actively want to harm us. And that's rare. There have been people in my life who actively have tried to harm me. But that's definitely in the minority. Most people who have harmed me had no intention of harming me. It wasn't their interest. They had some other interest, and I was unavoidable damage as far as they were concerned. But nobody can harm me, whether somebody intends to harm me or doesn't intend to harm me and harms me as collateral damage, unless Krishna sanctions it. I've had people try to harm me, and it had no effect at all. I've had people maliciously, nastily, horribly, vindictively try to harm me, and I know that because they told me so. I'm not interpreting. They told me, I would like to destroy you. I hate you. And there was no effect. They couldn't do anything. And I've had people try to help me, and they couldn't do anything. Whether people harm me or help me, whether they're malicious, whether they're caring, whether they're neutral, it doesn't matter. What happens to me is only what's sanctioned by Krishna. And generally speaking, what happens to me is only because of my own karma. So if somebody hurts me, whether they were malicious or not, and I get hurt, that's because that I've done something. I'm getting back my own reaction. The only person who really can hurt me is myself. And the only person who can really help me is myself. So why would I be offended by somebody else? If I place an online order and I order the wrong thing, and the delivery man brings me the wrong thing, why would I be offended? I ordered the wrong thing. Other people in my life are simply the delivery people. That's all. And they're bringing me my karma, or they're bringing me the will of God. In either case, whether it's my karma or the will of God, there's some lesson in it for me. I am ultimately responsible for everything that happens to me. So why should I ever be offended? And if people are malicious and angry and hateful and vengeful, then they're suffering. Why would I be angry at them for that? I would just be compassionate to them for that. So this having this mood, and it's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying I can do it all the time. It's definitely not easy. But I do find that when I live that way, I'm very happy, and that we'll get to in a moment. But definitely when we live that way, we don't offend others. We have no reason to. Offending others is done almost entirely out of a kind of self-defense. That I feel that by offending others and hurting others and insulting others, I'm going to protect myself, or I'm going to protect others that I love. And if I'm fearless, then I have no reason to behave like that. So the Bhagavatam talks about how we should deal with others. This is described by Narada to Dhruva, where he says, when there are others who are more advanced, you're joyful to see them. You see them with joy, with service. When they're equal, you make friendship. When they're lower, you deal with them with compassion. And he says, if you do this, you'll be free from the material miseries. So this is how we should deal with others. If they're more advanced, we're joyful, we serve. If they're equal, we're friends. If they're lower, we bring them up. And we make a decision, I am not going to get offended. That when something happens to us where our body and mind have this reaction, this chemical reaction of I've been offended, we look at that with detachment. It says that in this pastime, how Jed Bharata did feel waves of dissatisfaction from Rahugana's insult, but he just ignored them. One doesn't repress them, one just ignores them. It's like this is, it's not, it's a biochemical reaction of the body. So the result, as we said, Narada Muni says that one will become free from miseries. And I've always found this fascinating, that if we were to treat people without ever offending them, we wouldn't have any miseries. That tells me that all of our miseries come from mistreating others. Quite interesting. And on a practical level, it's very liberating, even in that moment, that nobody can offend me. That if people physically attack me, if they verbally attack me, if they take away my home, my money, my status. Actually, St. Francis of Assisi said something like this, that great joy is if you're traveling at night in the freezing rain and you come to a monastery and they don't let you in, even though they know that you're a fellow monk, without any cause, they don't let you in and they make you stay out in the freezing rain, and you're not affected by it. That's joy. That's freedom. And a question we can ask ourselves when our mind and body are screaming at us that we're supposed to be offended is, what do I want? Do I want to justify my anger and my hurt, or do I want freedom? What do I want more? One feels freedom in the moment. And it's not callousness. It's not that we don't care. In fact, we can feel compassion for the person who did something that's difficult. And we might reach out and try to rectify the relationship. But the inner sense of that I've been offended, when one's free from that, it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And of course, ultimately, it's not just that we achieve. But if we don't offend the Vaishnavas, then going back to what we said at the beginning, the opposite is true. Krishna's pleased, and the Vaishnavas are pleased. And when the Vaishnavas are pleased, then they will instruct us in transcendental knowledge, and they will help us to achieve the eternal abode. So these are easy things to talk about and very hard things to do. They're extremely hard things to do. Especially in Kali Yuga, the age of quarrel, where people are fighting just to fight. You know, like these boxers and wrestlers, they fight as a sport. Boxing particularly. And my father always thought that was an abominable sport. And I agree. I mean, how horrible. What kind of sport is that? You're punching somebody and trying to knock them unconscious. For sport. Oh, so this is fun, you know? Causing somebody permanent brain damage, or American footballs like that. And it's just, I was reading this recently, there was a Super Bowl in America, and now that people can watch television, you know, at any time on these different streaming services, they said that the Super Bowl is practically the only time when millions of people are simultaneously watching the same thing. And people are taking delight in fighting for the sake of fighting. What are they fighting over? I mean, just like whether or not you get a ball at a certain place on a field. It's ridiculous. And they're getting, you know, lifetime injuries from this. Brain injuries. I mean, just insanity. But people like to fight to fight. They just fight to fight. They just want to fight. Doesn't matter what they're fighting about. So especially in Kali Yuga, it's a very difficult. We're really in a time where being inoffensive and unoffendable is a humongous tapasya. I mean, it's for most of us, it's a much bigger tapasya than, you know, the kind of things that Dhruva did and Prithu Maharaj and, you know, Rani Kashipu, where they're going out in the forest and they're not eating. It's like we can do that more easily than we can be unoffendable and inoffensive. Some people seem to do this very naturally. I think we all know people who just don't get offended and don't offend others. You know, we've all met some people like that. They just don't take offense and they don't offend others. But for most of us, it's not so easy. But if we can achieve this, work on it, baby steps, at least to become aware, oh, the reason that I'm lashing out is that I feel offended. Just to develop some awareness of it, just to kind of separate ourself, the soul, from the various thoughts and feelings that go through us. Or to think that just because somebody's done some heinous crime, that therefore I can go around criticizing everybody. And I don't have to regard anybody as a devotee anymore, and I don't have to be respectful anymore. I'm just just to be aware of this, this kind of things, because without it, we're just going to keep rotating, as Prabhupada's quoting in this purport. We're just going to take birth again and again and again. We won't have any way out. And we may, you know, think that we're a great champion and we're revealing all the pretenders and all the this and the that, but we're the ones who are going to take birth after birth after birth. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements.
Muted.
Insults.
Unmuted.
I have a question.
Yes.
But,
yes, Robert.
But I'm this. No, Vijay Krishna has a. Okay. Anyway, I'll go ahead. So I need to just give a little detail. That's all. Somebody stole my life savings, and they also stole the life savings of many, many, many other devotees. I mean, a lot of other devotees.
Wow.
Many devotees on this, some to know about it.
All right.
To call a spade a spade, how, if you recognize detached that this person factually stole my life savings and so many others, how can you then be avoid not being affected by that? And then if you say, well,
okay,
I'm
well, wait, stop a minute. You're going to be affected by it practically. On a practical level, if someone stole your life savings, you will take you will have to take certain practical steps. Right? You may report them to the police if that's possible. If you can prove that a crime was committed, you will take steps to try to protect whatever assets you have left, if you have any left. You will not enter into any kind of financial dealings with that person anymore. You might warn other people, hey, this is a person who's going to steal your money. They've stolen my money. They've stolen money of these and this and this people. Okay, go on.
Sorry, I muted myself. Okay, well, I mean, that's the gist of it. I hear what you're saying. It sounds really great, but practically speaking, like, for instance, with this particular instance, there was nothing that anybody could do. So how can you avoid not being frustrated, not, you know, wouldn't mind to see the other person, you know, get a little...
Okay, well, that frustration is going to enter your mind and body. But you don't have to identify with it. I mean, Prabhupada told this to Peter Burwash, to never hate the instrument of your karma. That person couldn't have stolen from you. I mean, I've told this story before. So I was in a situation about 20 years ago where I had no money. I mean, really like nothing. Maybe I had a few dollars. I mean, I just really had like nothing. And I had some money that I had saved up, but I had given it all of it, every penny of it, to a devotional project that was struggling, and I had nothing. So I went to stay in the Puerto Rico ashram, and one of my dear friends, Jayashree, was running a business. So she asked, one of her workers had quit, so she asked me to take over her work, and the work was hellish for me. We were selling cosmetics at a kiosk in a mall, and it's as far from my nature as you can get to do work like that. It was really hellish. Plus, we had to drive up and down the mountain, which made me sick. I mean, altogether, it was awful. But I did it out of love for Jayashree, and I was paid by commission. So I was making about $50 a week. So after working there 2 weekends, I work once a week on Saturday, I had $100. That was all that I had. I mean, it was literally everything that I had. So normally, we left our rooms unlocked. But on Sundays, we usually locked the rooms because guests would come. Anyway, that Sunday, I forgot to lock my room. And I was giving the Sunday feast lecture, and I was talking about detachment. You know, whatever Krishna gives you, you accept. Whatever Krishna takes away, you accept. And I go back to my room, and someone stole my $100. And I just...
This is a great story.
I just cracked up. I was just cracking up. I couldn't stop laughing. I'm like, okay, Krishna, I'm just sitting on the Vyasa Sun talking about detachment. And then, you know, I thought that Krishna did it. That ultimately Krishna did it. And that's how we... And I wasn't disturbed by it. I mean, on a practical level, it was disturbing. It's hard to be absolutely penniless. I'm not going to say that it isn't. It is. You know, that means I was absolutely dependent on other people for anything. But it was Krishna. And I'm still alive today. I survived, you know, and never ended up eating out of garbage pails living on the side of the road. So ultimately it's Krishna. Prabhupada said when good things happen, we see that. You know, if somebody walks up to you and hands you $100 and says, hey, you know, here's a gift for you. Oh, we ultimately understand it's Krishna. When someone steals $100, then we, oh, how dare you steal that? No, it's Krishna. And if you can't do anything on the practical level, then you can't do anything on the practical level. I mean, often you can. Often you can. With this thing in Puerto Rico, I had no idea who stole the money. There was nothing I could do at all. You know, but if you know who stole it and you can report them, then that's your duty to society to do that. But without malice. And again, some frustration will arise. That's natural. I mean, it's just natural that some frustration will arise. But Mari Krishna Rakhe K, Rakhe Krishna Mari K. Ultimately, if something happens, it's Krishna doing it. And we look, where do I go from here? What does Krishna want me to do? How does Krishna want me to respond? And this kind of thing happened to Srila Prabhupada. You know, Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita manuscript was stolen. Who steals a handwritten book manuscript? What a thing to steal. And Prabhupada rewrote it. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't have. If someone stole, you know, a several hundred page written book manuscript that I had produced, I wouldn't do it again. But he did. The Pandavas' kingdom was stolen through cheating. I mean, these things happen even to great devotees who have no karma. And I will tell you, I can't always practice this. There's times that it's extremely difficult. But even when it's extremely difficult, it's possible to step back and say, the problem is not the person who hurt me. The problem is my struggle with detachment. Now, I can do that. I can't always detach myself from my thoughts and feelings, but I can always be aware that that's my problem, not the behavior of the other person. Again, the other person may need to be reported to the police and put in jail. I don't have a problem with that. In fact, it's our duty to do that. If we're talking about, you know, rape and murder and things like that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for sharing something personal like that, because that really helps.
Oh, good. Good. I mean, it was... And again, I mean, $100 meant a lot when that was all that I had. And now...
Okay. Mine was a lot more.
Yeah. But, you know, if that's all you have... And I was in a temple ashram. I was in a position of extreme vulnerability. So it was a pretty heavy thing. But... You know, from an external point of view, it was actually a pretty heavy thing. But I didn't feel that way about it. You know, there have been things that people have done to me that have really bothered me for a very long time. But that's my lack of Krishna consciousness. And I'm aware of that. That doesn't mean that I can snap my fingers and immediately be more Krishna conscious than I am. I'm not able to do that either. But I am able to understand that the problem is my own lack of advancement. Does that make sense? Is that understandable, Ramananda Prabhu?
Yes, it all makes sense. It's just hard to apply.
It is. But when it's hard to apply, at least step back and say, if I really knew that Krishna was behind this, and I really knew... We have in today's verse, Vishvasurit, that Krishna is the friend of the universe. that if I really believe that Krishna is my friend, and I really believe that no one can harm me unless Krishna feels that that so-called harm is good for me, if I actually believed that, then this anger and frustration and so forth would just pass through me like rivers going into the ocean. And the reason that I'm holding on to it, and the reason that I'm swimming, that I'm, you know, drinking it and swimming it and so forth, is that I ultimately don't believe that Krishna's in control and that he's my best friend. I believe that I know better what's good for me. And that's my ultimate problem. Not that so-and-so stole my money, or that, you know, that so-and-so borrowed my car and smashed it, or whatever, or even more horrible things, that, you know, my kid got raped, or whatever, you know, that's not the problem. And I find that to be helpful. At least it helps me to kind of ride it out, and with some patience, and to keep redirecting my consciousness back to the truth, and to avoid being an offensive toward the other person. You know, that it really helps. Yes, Vijay, Krishna Prabhu.
Mother Urmila, my question is in the chat box.
Well,
do you want me to read it?
Well, yeah, I see there. You're saying, order me, I do need to deal with insults in the most careful way, and Lord Jesus taught us about offering the other face. Why offering the other face? In other words, I am willing, please listen carefully, everyone who hears this is going to want to punch me in the face, that to be willing to be insulted and harmed, because you know what? We're going to be. If we're going to live in this world, especially in Kali Yuga, people are going to hurt us. That is an absolute guarantee. I will absolutely, totally, 100% guarantee that if you live in this world for any length of time, especially in Kali Yuga, you know, maybe you can go for a day or two, or maybe a week, or maybe even a month, but sooner or later, someone's going to lie to you, someone's going to steal from you, someone's going to betray you, someone's going to disappoint you, or they may do something really horrible to you. It's guaranteed. Absolutely. Why not joyfully accept that that is the fact? Because no matter how much we try to protect ourselves, and we should try to protect ourselves because we belong to Krishna, but no matter how much we protect ourselves, absolutely that's going to happen. Why not joyfully embrace it? Just like my body's getting old. It doesn't matter how well I eat and how much I exercise and how much positive thoughts I have. And it wouldn't matter if I dyed my hair and had plastic surgery or whatever. My body's getting old. It just is. I can joyfully embrace that. There's benefits to getting old. There's benefits to being poor. There's benefits to being insulted.
And what is the benefit of offering the other face?
That we find joy in everything. We find Krishna in everything. That nobody can take my joy.
Of course.
That nobody can take my joy away. Now, we do have some duty to protect ourselves. But if that protecting ourselves becomes feeling offended, then we're in trouble. But we want to have a joy that is irrespective of whether we have $5 million in the bank or nothing. That's a joy that's irrespective of whether I'm able-bodied or in a wheelchair, unable to speak. Whether the world loves me and praises me, or whether everybody hates me. We want to have a joy that's not dependent on those things. And one way to get that is, I just like this turn the other cheek. You probably can find it on YouTube. But I saw this video one time of this guy who was really struggling with being rejected. It was, you know, it was really, anytime anybody rejected something with him, it was really hurting him. So what he decided to do is he decided that he would intentionally do things that were likely to result in people rejecting him. That he would do just like kind of outrageous things so that people would be most likely to reject him. And that he was going to do 100 of such things. Now, what was funny is that the things he did didn't always result in rejection. But, like, you know, going up to a stranger and offering to buy them a meal or something. But what he said happened is, after doing this for a while, he became immune to all this negative self-esteem of being rejected. It became like a fun game. You know, it's a similar idea of like fasting. You know, practicing fasting on fast days. And then if you're in a situation where there's no food for whatever reason, you're not affected by it. And we have, actually, Jed Bharata and King Rishabhdev, and in the end of his life, Maharaj Yudhisthira, they did exactly this kind of thing. They behaved in such a way that people were likely to be nasty to them. And in this way, they developed this detachment. It becomes almost like a game. You know, it becomes just something kind of fun. And it just ceases to matter anymore. And it's not, that's the opposite of masochistic. It's real love for yourself. That I am a soul. It just, these other things really don't matter. Again, we have some duty to Krishna to protect our body and mind because they're his. But that's different. If I want to try to protect my body and mind because I think it's me and it's my identity and it's the source of all of my happiness, and, you know, I mean, one thing, Ramananda, is what I've seen, I've been rich and I've been poor and in between and every, you know, is that I've never lived out on the street. I've always had a roof, always had something to eat, always had clothes, always had friends.
Agreed.
And, you know, even if it came to that, there was this man, he's passed away now, but he used to live out on the street by the Krishna Balaram tree in Vrindavan. Once they paved that area, then he was living on the side of the street. And he had no possessions, as in, like, he was naked. Like, he really had no possessions. People would give him blankets, so he always had a blanket. But he didn't wash it. I mean, just periodically people would give him a new blanket. And there were food vendors on that portion of the Parikrama Marg. And people would regularly buy food, you know, the pilgrims walking on the Parikrama Marg. He didn't beg. They would regularly buy food and give it to him. And he had friends. I mean, the food vendors there and some of the residents, and I would see them, they'd hang out together in the evenings. I mean, it was a hard life. Vrindavan gets very cold in the winter and very hot in the summer, and to be just outside in the elements. But he had food, he had a blanket, he had friends. And he lived. He lived there for like 14 years. And so ultimately, even if Krishna takes away everything, even if we don't have a roof and we don't have food and we don't have anything, you know, ultimately we're under the protection of the Lord. And we're thinking, you know, I need to have this, I need to have that. But ultimately we don't. We really don't. And when these things happen, I see it as Krishna's way of reminding us that I can be happy and I can be Krishna conscious even if externally I don't have any of the things I think that I need. And it really helps us then when we do have those things to remember that they're Krishna's and that they're for service, they're not for my feelings of security. That's what I see. I don't know. I've been through a lot. People have told me to write a book. I'll never do it. But, you know, I've been through people praising me, people hating me, living in beautiful houses, living in closets. I mean, you know, the whole gamut. And happiness doesn't really depend on that, does it?
Haribol's my hand up. I just wanted to add to the... You were mentioning Ram Dass, you know, and Raghunath Bhatta.
Yeah.
But it's funny, and it always struck me as really funny, that in the actual purport, Ram Dass was very learned in all revealed scripture. This is Ram Dass Vishvash.
Yes.
He was a teacher of the famous book Kavya Prakash. He was known as an advanced devotee and worshipper of Lord Ram.
Yes.
And Prabhupada says, commenting on the word Parma Vaishnav, because it says Parma Vaishnav in the Bengali. Okay. Bhaktivinoda says, anyone who desires to merge into the existence of the Lord cannot be a pure Vaishnava, but because Ram Dass Vishvas was a great devotee of Lord Ramchandra, he was almost a Vaishnava. So that's funny in itself, because generally we think of Ram Bhaktas as Vaishnava. I mean, you know, like Murari Gupta or anybody. So, and here, Prabhupada's saying something that's, you know, it's kind of hysterical. And then he says, in those days, no one could distinguish between a pure Vaishnava and a pseudo Vaishnava. In those days, they were seeing me smarter than we are now. You know, like nowadays, we know.
Yeah, like I haven't found that we're any better at it nowadays. You know?
I always get a kick out of that purport. I was like, it's just funny. Certain things that Prabhupada writes are just hysterical. Every time I read them, you know, like where... Another one is where Sanatana Goswami was being advised by Jagadananda, and Lord Chaitanya says, why do you listen to Jaga? He's a new boy. But actually, he knew Lord Chaitanya longer than anyone else, like since they were six or seven. He's a new boy. Like, what? You know, it's like, kind of like funny. Like, what? How are you advising Sanatana? He's like, my guru. A funny thing is, one time I was just reading through, sometimes I'm reading through, and I'm coming to this conversation, I think it was Nairobi, and these life members, Indians obviously, seemingly, probably, most likely, they're telling Prabhupada, Swamiji, we come to your temple, and this is way back, you know, when your boys, your local boys, they're not here, usually they go to the Swami Narayan temple to eat. You know, like, they're not even at your own program at their temple. And probably just like kind of, I best could forensically find how he says it, but probably says, when you read it, he says, oh, they're not devotees. Was he just saying that, like, to pacify those Indians? But, you know, they're not devotees, you know. I don't know if Prabhupada would do something like that, you know.
Wow.
There's that time where Akshayananda was getting sannyas, and it was being televised in Amsterdam in 73, and Prabhupada got so disturbed because nothing was prepared. They didn't have any fruit, no flour, nothing. And it's being televised, so people all over Amsterdam could see it. He's yelling at Akshayananda, and he's giving him sannyas. And then later I heard that some of the devotees, you know, in Amsterdam, they were walking around, and people had seen the program, said, well, your guru was really heavy, you know. He didn't mind. It was on TV, and he was blasting the guy, you know. I mean, it's hard to believe he was just being, like, genteel by saying they're not devotees. I mean, chances are they're not. Then none of them stayed there, you know. But, I mean, we hear stories that they were stealing Prabhupada's clothes off the line, you know, stuff like that. But,
oh, my goodness.
I don't know if it's the same exact guys, but there's so many funny things happen, you know.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I need to get going because I've got a meeting in 15 minutes. But you just hearing you, I'm just being so appreciative of this mood of reading the scripture where you're really entering into the personalities and their interchanges. You know, it's very sweet. Thank you, Pushkar Prabhu.
Yeah, I won't bring up any more. You better
Yeah,
go.
No, I really do have to go. Okay, Hare Krishna.
Okay.
Hare Krishna, thank you very much.